I'm going to read the verses, and then we're going to dive right in. So starting in verse 18, Romans chapter 1. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power, and his divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. For even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. In Fleming Rutledge's book, The Crucifixion, Understanding the Death of Jesus Christ, she acknowledges the difficulty that modern people have with the concept of God's wrath. Maybe you have difficulty with it here this morning. Nevertheless, she writes, there can be no turning away from this prominent biblical theme. But forget the Bible for a moment, she says. Don't we have wrath too? A slogan of our times, Rutledge writes, is where's the outrage? Well, I think we see it every day, don't we? It's been applied from everything from Big Pharma's market manipulation to astronomical wealth to police officers and so on. Where's the outrage? Inquire many, wondering why congressmen, officials, and ordinary voters seem indifferent. The public is outraged all over cyberspace. I think if you go on Facebook today, you can see all the outrage over things that annoy people personally. The not in my backyard syndrome, but outrages in the heart of God go unnoticed and unaddressed. If we are resistant to the idea of the wrath of God, we might pause to reflect the next time we are outraged about something, whatever it may be. All of us are capable of being angry over things. God's anger, however, is pure. The wrath of God is not an emotion that flares up from time to time as though God has temper tantrums. It is a way of describing his absolute enmity against all wrong and his coming to set matters right. The world doesn't want to hear that, do they? The world doesn't want to hear about the wrath of God. You'll be hard-pressed to find many even sermons on the wrath of God. Why? Because it's just not a popular topic. It's archaic almost, from a more uncivilized time. The world doesn't want to hear about the wrath of God because, by and large, folks, the world doesn't want to hear about God. The world wants to ignore the truths of God. They want to ignore the existence of God. They want to ignore the character of God. And they want to ignore their own accountability to God. And it is that suppression, as they suppress that truth in their unrighteous behavior, that actually causes the wrath of God. And that's what we see here in our sermon here this morning. God's righteous indignation, and it is a pure and righteous indignation, is against, is being presently revealed against man's unrighteous suppression. People want to live the way they want to live. They want to disregard all of the evidence of God. They want to do their own things, and they suppress the truth in unrighteousness. This is all about truth, about knowing it and living it. And for us, that's what we want to do. So therefore, we're going to talk about passages in Scripture that may make us feel a little bit uncomfortable, but it is an absolute truth that we need to know, especially if we are going to witness to a world that is suppressing it. The first two verses form the main thrust of Paul's argument here. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness, unrighteousness of men who do what? Suppress the truth and unrighteousness. Why? Because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. It begins the argument, and then what follows is a full-blown description of what this suppression and their behavior looks like. Paul's goal here is evangelistic. He wants to bring people to faith in Jesus Christ. In order to do that, they need to see the predicament that they fall under, and you and I need to do the same. There are two things being revealed from heaven. The first one is in verse 17. It's the righteousness of God. The second thing is in 18, it is the wrath of God. Those are the two choices that mankind has. We can either accept the righteousness of God by believing in Jesus Christ and having faith in him. If we don't accept the righteousness of God, then God's righteous wrath is upon us. That's what we have. That's what many in this world fall under right now today. Now, before we dive into this, it's a reminder for all of us. This sermon is not about pointing our fingers at them and saying, look at how wicked they are, God's wrath falls upon them. That's not what it's about. It's about understanding the predicament that the unbeliever falls under, that the unbeliever lives in, so that you and I can better witness to those individuals, right? We need to understand that, and we need to share with them the truth of God's wrath. Paul reminds you and me that we were all once like them. As a matter of fact, he said we were all children of what? Wrath. If not for the grace of God, which we are celebrating here this morning, you and I would still be under that wrath. So let's not forget that. And our response should be one of thankfulness to that grace and a humility as we talk to people in this world and a compassion for them because we can relate to where they're at. There are two actions that are being done here in our section. God's wrath is being revealed, and they are suppressing the truth. The one is leading to the other. They are actively doing it. It is a willful suppression. It is a daily suppression. That which is both evident in them and that which is evident to them. So this is all general revelation. And here's just a quick, before we dive into the meat of this passage, this is all general revelation. And people reject the general revelation of God. He made himself known in two ways, in our conscience, which is, I believe, is what Paul's saying, evident in them. And he, later on in chapter 2, is going to show that. And then And when he says the woke mind, that's not the term that we use today. And then in creation, in the whole world, in the things that have been made, and that's what he's saying here. It's evident, it is clear to them, but man has rejected this revelation, and because of that, they fall underneath God's wrath. Now, we're not going to see that wrath until verse 24, really. We see parts of the judgment in this section. However, this is the reason why for the wrath in this first section from 18 to 23. This is the reason why from it. We don't see what it looks like until 24. But as that woman shared with us, God's wrath is not some outburst of anger. It's a settled disposition. It's not uncontrollable, but it is emotional. It's an emotional anger towards all sin and all of its manifestations. And in order for people to appreciate the mercy of God and to see their need for the mercy of God, they first have to understand the wrath of God. This is somewhat progressive, and we're going to see three stages as we go through this here. So the first stage is God revealing himself to them through what he has made. And because of that, they have all the evidence that they need, that God exists, revealing his character and his nature, and it gives them absolutely no excuse. They can say absolutely nothing to the fact that God has not revealed himself to them. Verse 21, notice what he says here. Verse 20, that's wrong. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power, and his divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made. So they are without excuse. I had such a good time researching this message. This was just packed full of things, and I didn't include all of them. Probably you'll be thankful for that so I don't prolong this sermon. But one of the things that I came across was a church has a video online, and I actually wanted to show the video, but it was too long, so I didn't. So I'm just going to share with you the video. I will try to give you a link to the video if I can find it again. But it's a video that is really all about the audio, and it begins with the kind of the Earth is below the moon, and what it is, it's of Apollo's 8 Christmas Eve message in 69 or 68, and maybe some of you remember Apollo 8's Christmas Eve message, and it's as they approach what's called the lunar sunrise and seeing the Earth over the horizon of the moon. And as they do, they are absolutely captivated by its beauty. And it shows the Earth coming up as they're coming across on the video. And as they see the beauty, one of the astronauts begins to speak. And he says, "We have a message to share with all the billions of people on Earth." And it's not a message that you would imagine. And here these guys are, these scientists, right? They're in a rocket, right? This is the height of man's technology. They are coming over the moon and seeing the Earth. And as they see the Earth, they can communicate with people on the Earth, thousands of miles away. And they only had one thought. And as they came over the top, he began to speak these words. In the beginning, God. And each astronaut took a turn reading the first 10 verses of Genesis. I cried as he was reading those verses. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they reveal knowledge. They have no speech. They use no words. No sound is heard from them. Yet their voice goes out into all the earth. Their words to the ends of the world. Yet people ignore it. They close their eyes and they shut their ears, but they are without excuse. Piper says God rejoices in the work of his creation because they point us beyond themselves to God. God does mean for us to be stunned and awed by it, which we are, but not for its own sake. God means for us to say something,
Piper says this, if the work of God's hands is so abundant in power and wisdom and majesty and grandeur and beauty, what must God be like? What must the Creator be like if the flinging out of his fingers is so majestic, grand, great, and glorious? God reveals himself how? Clearly in creation, and therefore man has absolutely no excuse. None. None whatsoever. Their mouths are shut before God. The idea here is it's like a courtroom, and there's the defendant, the unbeliever, and all of this evidence is brought forth. You know how they do exhibits, right? Exhibit A, exhibit B. There are not enough alphabets in the world to present all the exhibits of God's existence, glory, and majesty. And the unbeliever is therefore silenced. They have absolutely no defense. They have nothing to stand on. And don't let people fool you, making you think that they do. The evidence is in God's favor. The verdict is done. He exists. That's it. The evidence is so overwhelming, and they are found guilty for ignoring it. Two things are clearly seen: his eternal power and his divine nature. Even it's kind of like a oxymoron. It is the invisible God is what? Clearly seen. So the invisible God is seen in visible nature. His characteristics, what he's like. And so every morning that the people in this world walk out of their house and throughout the day and every evening, God is greeting them saying, here, look. And the exploration of our world should only lead us to an exploration and a search for God. They see his attributes, his mercy and his grace in the sun, in the rain, and his glory in the blooming flowers, his mystery in the depths of the sea, his holiness and wrath in the storms and volcanoes, his wisdom and sovereignty as he controls it all. Visible nature speaks to nature's invisible God. D.L. Moody once said that excuses are the cradle that Satan rocks men off to sleep in. That's exactly what's going on today. People have a lot of excuses. God hasn't revealed himself to us. I want an epiphany. No one can say that God did not give me opportunity. As one author says, nature is God's first missionary. But like Peter tells us, what do? Deliberately. It's willful. They deliberately overlook the fact that long ago, by God's word, the heavens existed and the earth was formed out of water and by water. So I think for us, right, we have to understand. Sometimes we want to just give people the gospel, but we actually need to do some pre-evangelism first. People aren't even believing in the existence of God. And if you're a shy witness, then let nature speak for you, right? Isn't that what you can do? Point to nature and show people and say, hey, well, what do you make of this? Here's all the evidence you need. As a matter of fact, God says he's given that evidence. Your own conscience is evidence, and allow nature, take them to nature to speak to God as creator, and then bring them down the road. But they ignore it. They suppress it. And that's why God's angry with them. And as they do, as they fail to acknowledge him and give him glory, they further corrupt their mentality. Verse 21, for even though they knew God, they know he's existing, They can see him in creation. They did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Like I said, I got really excited researching this, especially things in nature. And I found this out. Did you know bees see in UV light? Did anyone know that? Am I the only one who just, like, did not know that? Because I felt stupid, like I should know that. Isn't that beautiful? That's what a flower looks like to a bee. So they can hone in because that's the way they're made. And I'm thinking to myself, that's amazing. There's a world, there's an invisible world that I cannot see right now, but actually exists and exists like this to other creatures. My first response was what? Worship. I'm like, holy cow, God, you're amazing. And it made me think of heaven. And I'm thinking, man, I have no idea. What, isn't that what he says? The eye has not seen or the ear has heard what God has prepared for those who love him? Man, it just really, really piques your curiosity and humbles you at the same time. But not everyone has that. I'm a Christian, that's why I have that response. And my heart is brightened. But other people who don't acknowledge him, their heart is what? Darkened. And it gets only worse. There was another, this was on Facebook, it was a Facebook post. This little guy, and he's tiny, he's a gnat. He's called the Goniorella tridens. It's a fruit fly. Forgive the spear, he had a bad day. It's a gladiator fruit fly. And do you guys notice the wings? Does everyone see it? When I first saw it, I'm like, they're babies. I'm like, that freak fly carries babies in its wings. They're not babies. No, they are actually, it's actually just a pattern. It's a pattern that mimics either ants or a spider. And what this fly, this silly little fruit fly, does is when it's going to get attacked by a predator, it flutters its wings and it looks like a colony of ants, and the predator is going to not want to mess with a colony of ants, a bunch of ants attacking it. So this is on Facebook, and you can read the two responses. The first response is would be our response, praise God, man, that's absolutely amazing. It's a fruit fly. And he took that much care and concern for a fruit fly. But the other responses are not like that. As a matter of fact, if you Google the fruit fly and you look up what it says about it, it says, this showcases impressive evolutionary adaptation through its wings. Really? Which feature intricate, so there's the word intricate, very intricate. Ant-like patterns, when waved, mimic a swarm of ants to deter predators. A display that evolved via natural selection to enhance survival. And then on the comments beneath the thing, this is what one guy says. People have a proclivity to make sense of everything they encounter. Okay, it's how our minds operate. Filling up that which we don't comprehend with imaginary patterns. I ain't imagining nothing. Yeah, what's the first thing you thought? Are we all imagining the same thing? That's kind of weird. So to make sense of our personal worldview, really? Who's imagining things? That guy is. And then he says it has nothing to do with reason or reality. Evolution is a reality, whether you believe it or not. You've got to be kidding me. And then one lady says, if it was a perfect image of an ant, then I can suggest create. I'm like, huh? What do you want, folks? You couldn't draw something better than that. You think evolution can? But that's the response. What do? They fail to acknowledge him. They fail to give him glory. They fail to give him thanks. No wonder God's angry with them. That's crazy. Yet although they knew him, they did not glorify him.
And they did not give him thanks. That's one of the first things I think we see for all of us. As you and I behold and partake in nature, it should evoke glory and thanks to God, should it not? We should continually, as we experience his creation, give him glory and thank him for it. And as we do, be a witness to those around us. I thought about this thankfulness idea. It came up this past week. And hey, can you imagine doing something for somebody over and over and over and over and over and over and over again? Maybe you're caring for them. Maybe you're taking care of their daily needs. Maybe you're cooking them a meal over and over and over again. Maybe you're being a friend to them. Whatever it is, can you imagine doing that over and over and over and over again and that person ignoring you and never ever thanking you? How are you going to feel? How do you feel when you're unappreciated? Well, this is the God of all creation. And his very creation is turning against him, not acknowledging him, not thanking him. The story of Jesus and the 10 lepers is the story of the world. You have one person that turns back and gives thanks, and none of them come back and recognize his awesomeness. And as they do, as they push away the light of God, their minds and their hearts are darkened. That's where people are at. That's the condition that they are in. Futile thinking and a darkened heart. I don't know about you, I've been getting upset with people lately. I feel like people have lost their minds. Well, here you go, right? Should we be surprised at what we see happening in this world? No. Here's your answer. It's futile thinking means it's worthless. It's empty. There's no substance to it. Their minds are just pointless. So instead of frustration, we should have compassion. There's no depth to it. They suppress the truth and they make up their own truth. They reject the truth and they believe and proclaim a lie. Look at futile thinking. Here you go. What is that? That's where we've come from? When you put it on a screen, it looks really weird, doesn't it? And I, not to make fun of it, but this is where people's minds are going, right? I don't look like that dude at the end. Give him a shirt. But look, that's where we're at. It's crazy. It's insanity. And we replace God with insane thinking. And the further people go from God, the worse they're going to get. As one author said, read this quote. This is current day religious philosopher guy. There is no God, there is no God, there is no God. He says it three times. He who invented God is a what? A fool. Do you notice? It's like reversing it. It's Satan flipping it. We're the fools. He who propagates God is a scoundrel, so we're actually bad and evil. And he who worships God is not wise, but a barbarian, right? Do you see that? That's current day philosophy, belief. You know, one author says, man who is supposed to be the worshiper becomes the philosopher making nonsense, speaking nonsense. And we see this everywhere. Paul saw it all over the place. He was surrounded by philosophers.
People who, as we're going to see, were professing to be what? Wise. But Paul says they're fools. He's directly attacking the culture of his time. Attacking their beliefs, their musings, and their wanderings of thought. All the people would gather to hear these philosophers. And they'd be awed by their brilliance. And Paul says, it's a bunch of nonsense. It's a bunch of foolishness. A warped foundation leads to warped houses and very, very dark ones at that. There is no light in these people. The darkness of heart is a moral darkness. You want to know what's going on in man's heart? It's dark. It's a foolish heart. The man who is the fool is someone who cannot learn, as one author says, the lesson of experience. The dark heart needs the light of the gospel. These are people who don't properly use the mind and brain that God has given them. There's no understanding of morality or religion or of God. They think futilely and they live immorally. That's the deceitfulness of sin. That's the predicament of the majority of people in this world. That's who we need to witness to. No wonder God's angry with them. They have rejected him, cursed him, abandoned him. It happens to them. The verb is in the passive tense, and they're doing it to themselves, and God is giving them over to it. We're going to see that more specifically in the next section. It's like when Pharaoh hardened his heart. It only gets worse. In his book, The Magician's Nephew, C.S. Lewis writes of the creation of fictitious Narnia through the Song of Aslan, the lion who represents Jesus in the book. I'm sure you're familiar with the story. The creation song is clearly intended to reveal the majesty and the glory of Aslan. As in Genesis 1, it is a grand call to worship, but there was one man, this guy here, depicted here. His name was Uncle Andrew, or Andrew Ketterly, I think it was, and he would not hear the song. The consequences were staggering. When the great moment came and the beast spoke, he missed the whole point for a rather interesting reason. You see, long before, when Aslan had first begun singing, when it was quiet and dark, he realized, Uncle Andrew did, that the noise was a song. But it was a song that he had disliked very, very much. You see, the song made him think and feel things that he did not want to think and feel at all. Then when the sun rose and he saw the singer was a lion, only a lion, he said to himself. He tried his hardest to make himself believe that the lion wasn't singing and never had been singing, only roaring as any lion in a zoo might do in our own world. Of course, can't really have been singing, he thought. I must have imagined it. I'm letting my nerves get out of order. Who ever heard of a lion singing? And the longer and more beautifully the lion sang, the harder and harder Uncle Andrew tried to make himself believe that he could hear nothing but roaring. Now, the trouble, the author says, about trying to make yourself stupider than you really are is you often succeed. Uncle Andrew did, and he soon heard nothing but roaring in Aslan's song. Soon he couldn't have heard anything else even if he wanted to. And when at last the lion spoke and said, "Narnia, awake," he didn't hear any words. He heard only a snarl. And when the beasts replied in answer, and he heard only barkings, growling, bayings, and howlings. There's a lot of Uncle Andrews in this world. They are individuals who
like Uncle Andrew, think they're wise, but they're really foolish. And in doing, and in thinking they're wise, they make a very, very foolish exchange. Verse 22 through 23. Professing to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and four-footed animals and of crawling creatures. Here's the end result here. One that we see everywhere. There is a claim, a profession. And what that word means, it's a very, very confident assertion. These people are very, very confident in what they believe. And we see it all over the place today, right? You see all the signs on the lawn. How many people see the sign, the lawn signs, right? Just a, it's their duck, it's their creed, is it not? In science we trust, and whatever, whatever follows. And I know that that sometimes can shake us in our faith. It can sometimes, we sometimes feel like, oh, well, they're so sure of themselves. And then you and I begin to doubt, like, are we the crazy ones? But here's the thing. That's exactly what God says will happen, doesn't he? That's what they were doing in Paul's day. These were the philosophers, the sages of his time, going around and professing to be having all the wisdom and knowledge of the world. And Paul says, no, professing to be wise, they actually become fools. And in the Bible, the fool is the one who denies there is a God. But that's precisely what's happening in our world, right? They want to shut us up. They want to shut not us up. They want to shut up God. That's what they want to do. They want to suppress the truth, and they do so by making these confident assertions that they have all the information and all the knowledge and they know everything. That's what God says is going to happen. Claim to be wise while in reality being the fool, and their actions prove it. I want you to key in on some words here. It's very, very substantial, and that's one of the ideas here. Notice it's a trade-off. They make this trade. And they trade God's glory. When we see the word glory, especially in the Hebrew idea behind the word, it goes beyond the mere radiance of God. It is the very substance of God. It is the very weight of God. It is real. It is majestic. It is beautiful. And it is heavy. And notice what they are trading. They are trading that which is of substance, that which is substantial, for what? A form or an image. It's where we get our word icon from. It's just a picture. And the substance of God is what? Incorruptible. It is eternal. It is immortal. And they are trading that for which is what? Perishable. Something that is temporal and not real. Now, we see it all the time. But look, we got to remind ourselves. When we sin and we fall into our own idolatry, that's what we're doing. We're trading that which is good, that which is God, of God, God's glory, for that which is what? Of just nothing, junk. And we have to remind ourselves of that. And we see idolatry, this is what it is. It is the falling into idolatry. It is exchanging God and worshiping the creatures or whatever it is. And we can worship, people worship a lot of things today, some of which are listed here actually. We worship money, we worship pleasure, we can worship politics, we can worship ourselves. All of that is trading, exchanging God's goodness, God's glory, for that which is perishable and corruptible.
It's insanity. That's the insanity of sin. We give up on eternal life, or people give up on eternal life. Unbelievers give up on eternal life. They give up on that which is lasting, that which is beautiful and majestic, for that which is pitiful. Nothing. Hear what one commentator says about this exchange, and I think this is key for us today. Notice, this exchange does not bring about evolution, but devolution or degeneration. It's a passing onwards or downwards from one stage to another. Man is not progressing, but regressing. Man is going backwards, not forwards. The direction of man is not up, up, up. It's what? Down, down, down. Not getting better and better, but getting what? Worse and worse. Not reaching to the heights, but plummeting to the depths. Notice where man begins. The first thing man replaces God with is himself. It's the love of self. The worship of self. The very crown of God's creation, mankind, rejects his creator and turns in on himself. No wonder God is angry. And if that's not enough, they turn to birds, freaks like that. I mean, in Paul's day, there were examples everywhere. And maybe people don't worship birds today, but I'm sure some people do. But people worship what? Creation. Matter of fact, they put creation over humans, right? Everything that happened in the garden was a complete reversal of the way things should be. The creation, the snake, influenced the woman. And then the woman influenced the man. And then man ultimately blamed God. It was all flipped on its head. It's all upside down. And if the birds aren't enough, then they go to four-footed animals like our friend here. Snotty, smelly, flatulent animals. That's what we trade God's glory for. And look, that's going on right now. And that's a sacred cow in India. Those cows are sacred. And then if that's not far down enough, what do? They go to the bugs that eat refuse and decaying corpses. It doesn't make any sense. But this is where they're at. The creation, his crown of creation, who was made to be in a relationship with him, who was made to worship him, has chosen instead to worship themselves and those things that he has made to point to him and bring him glory, and his wrath is against all of it, and rightfully so, as they live in a lawless, immoral way. There was a dead possum outside my house when I lived on Reed Street a long time ago. And I noticed a girl drive up to said dead possum, got out of her car. I'm going to profile her. She was gothic, and I think she was a witch. I'll tell you why I think she was a witch. Because she got out of the car, and she picked up the possum, and I think she said a prayer of some sort. This is a dead possum, mind you. Those things are just nasty. She says this prayer, and then I'm pretty sure she did this because I think I told Sarah and I freaked out about it. She kissed the dead possum. Our hearts should go out to that individual. People lose their humanity of what we're created for and that's to be in a relationship with God. And you and I, we can sit here all day in disbelief and shake our heads and say, look at them. And as I went through this passage, I was reminded of a reminder that I have myself. That's similar to a tattoo that I have. I'm not here to talk about my tattoo, but it's an illustration. Do you notice what the picture is? It's two birds, isn't it? You see, there was a point in my life as I pushed God away and out of my life that I started making my way toward Native American spiritualism. I wanted to be a Native American. I wanted to be a PNA, Polish Native American. It was the only one in my area. Very rare. Very rare. And I would actually do the smudging, and I love the Native American culture, and thankfully God, I married a Native American. It's a beautiful culture. But I started engaging in this type of animistic worship. I even adopted a wolf because I thought the wolf was my spirit animal. And we can laugh, right? But this is where I was at in my heart. And I even taught classes. They let me, blonde hair, blue eye, Polish guy, teach classes on Lenape culture. And I'm thinking, I had no business doing that. And you look in disbelief, right? But that's where I was. My life reflected where my heart was. But then what happened? The God who had light shine out of darkness in creation is the same God who had light shine out of darkness in my heart. The light of the gospel. Light of the gospel to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. The gospel, the power of the gospel lifted me from worshiping creatures to worshiping the Creator, moving me from under God's righteous indignation to receiving His righteousness for salvation. That's the gospel that we need to be preaching to these people who fall under the wrath of God now. This is the answer to God's wrath. Christ took His wrath, God's wrath, upon Him so that you and I can receive the righteousness of Christ. And